morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu Radio with Ann and Peter Haig. And happy spring, everybody.
Yeah, well, sort of. It's spring today.
Yes.
Might not be spring tomorrow here in
Pittsburgh. I think it was summer yesterday. Spring today. Tomorrow back to winter.
Something like that. But what can you do? At least we're here with you, and wherever you are, you probably don't care about the weather because you're listening to our program, and we're delighted that you are. So thank you so much for joining us today. And today's theme, I guess, is a set of rather unusual and somewhat contrasting ingredients. Is that not the idea?
No,
of what we're doing today?
I wouldn't view that.
You wouldn't view it as that?
What would you view it as then? Well, I mean, I do think that duck is unusual.
Well, then we got vegan secrets, so you know, vegan secret suppers.
Different.
Well, it's different, but it's all about flavor.
It's
about vegan flavors. I thought it was a hoot to put duck and vegan in the same program.
Thank you.
And didn't think that was very amusing, but you folks share my sense of humor, I'm sure. And then we have a definitive interview all about that wonderful product called Balsamico. And then finally, some very special liquor for sipping after your dinner is over this evening. So that's today's lineup. And without further ado, the extraordinarily creative, extraordinarily innovative Gascon French lady, Arène Degan, has been up to revolutionizing the availability of gourmet products in this country for a very long time. I don't want to say 30 years, but it's a few.
Yeah.
But she's always up to something new, and this week is a new kind of duck, which we enjoyed and which we want to share with you.
I always love talking to Arène Degan because she's founder of one of my most favorite places to shop, D'Artagnan. Arène, could you give me like a one sentence describing D'Artagnan? Because I have a hard time summing up everything that you do there.
Well, we source and distribute the good meat, poultry, game birds, and the products that come from it, like the charcuterie. So we have foie gras and sausages and pâtés and smoked duck breast, things like that. And so that's it. We're just sourcing, organizing farmers and distributing it to the best restaurants in America, and now a lot of retail stores, and to the consumers too. We do have a small website.
What is that website?
D'Artagnan.com. It's www.d'Artagnan.com. D'Artagnan, like musketeer.
Exactly. And like the musketeer, your heritage is from the Gascon region of France.
Exactly, yes.
Where people were not very complimentary about, as I recall in the Three Musketeers, they're not very complimentary about D'Artagnan. They think he's some kind of oaf because he comes from Gascony. Now, you must obviously...
No, but we have a reputation, us Gascons have a reputation in France of being boisterous and like that, but also we have this reputation of having, like D'Artagnan in the book of Alexandre Dumas, where he's known to do things for the right reasons, you know, for putting his own mark in life and showing that he's doing it for the good of all and for the beauty of the gesture and not for the what's in it for me.
And you're doing exactly the same thing.
That's why I named my company after him.
Now, when did you start this?
28 years ago.
Wow.
My goodness. And part of it was out of a frustration that you couldn't get the things that you were surrounded by when you were growing up?
Not really. I was very young. Okay. I was still almost just out of school, Columbia University. And I was working in a small pâté, small charcuterie shop. And one day somebody came, two guys came with a foie gras. And they were saying that they starting the first duck farm in America to raise ducks for foie gras. And because in Gascony, foie gras is such a specialty and it's such highly recognized, I became very excited about that. For me, it was historical that America, for the first time, was going to have foie gras. And so that's when I left my employment and started my own business.
No, it's really funny. When I wasn't nearly as sophisticated a diner 35 or 40 years ago when Anne and I met for the first time. And one of the few dishes that I guess was high style that I liked was Tornado Rossini. So it was a filet with foie gras.
But you couldn't get the real foie gras.
And Anne used to make it for me, but it was always pâté de foie gras out of a tin.
You couldn't get the foie
because
gras.
Because there was no foie gras in the United States, as you were just describing.
There was none. There was none until 1985 when we started and the farm started in the same time.
Now, this is not what we're really going to be talking about further on, but I have a chance to ask you, so I will. Where do we stand now with the fight to maintain liberty and chance of being able to grow, produce, and eat foie gras?
Foie gras. Everything is okay and peachy except in California.
Okay.
So wherever the activists tried to ban foie gras, whether it was in the town of Chicago, whether it was in the state of Massachusetts, or the state of New York, or the state of New Jersey, or Maryland, everywhere they went like that, we were able to go and counter them. Unfortunately, they started with California. And we were not organized yet, and we had no idea when I say we, you know, the producers of foie gras in North America, we had no idea that it was going to go that way. So there, the problem is that the law was voted 7 years ago. So right now, we are fighting on both fronts. We are fighting, we actually have a lawsuit against the state of California, and we also have strong lobbying to show and to educate all the congressmen to explain why we don't think that raising ducks for foie gras is cruel. And we hope it's going to get somewhere because it's a lot of time, energy, and money. But meanwhile, it's difficult because this law has passed. It's easier to counter the project
before they actually have the law.
Yeah.
They just prosecuted some chef there. I don't know what.
No, we won that.
Oh,
we won
good.
That because the law is made in such a way that it's not applicable. So we want to show that the law is not applicable. We try to fight on as many fronts as possible to reverse that law, you know.
Well, congratulations, then. Now, when I think of D'Artagnan, I always think of duck, especially. I would never even think of buying duck breast anyplace else.
thanks. But true, our logo is like, or goose, you don't know, you know, a poultry with a hat, with a musketeer hat on top, so.
That was cute, it's cute too.
So you don't know the head, so you don't know which poultry it is really, but it does look awfully like a duck, that's for sure.
But what caught my attention is that you actually came out with a new breed of duck, and that's what you just said as a sample, we just tried cooking it, the Rohan duck. Whatever gave you this idea, and tell us about it.
Yes, we're very, very proud of that because on the market in America, basically you had 99%, you had the Peking duck, which is also known as the Long Island duck, which is a breed that has been genetically manipulated since World War II to get an animal that grows really, really fast. And in order to do that, 5 weeks and a half, which is unheard of in any other duck breed, 5 weeks and a half to get adult, you get a duck that has very sturdy bones and that has a very fatty skin and a very pale and watery meat. But because it's 5 weeks and a half, it's not expensive as duck go. And then you have other ducks, the Moulard duck, which has a foie gras, the Muscovy duck, the Mallard duck, and all those ducks were more for specialty, you know, more for fancy restaurants who wanted a really good duck on the plate. And so we really put our heads together and tried to create a breed that would be not much more expensive than Peking, that you could roast whole like that, but that would be as tasty as those other breeds.
Tasty. This is the thing about it.
It's amazing, eh?
It is. I mean, it tastes like essence of duck.
Did you have the concept and you found the farmer, or did the farmer have the concept and find you?
It was a combination, like with everything. D'Artagnan, we have only one mission, and the mission is that at the end, on the plate, you have the best ingredient possible. And so over the years, we realized that what I was raised in France with is true, which is that in order to get the best and the tastiest meat possible, you need to raise the animal the right way. And so you need to raise the animal without hormones, without antibiotics, without medication, with room to roam around, humanly, without stress, and to process it the right way at the end. And so with that as our motto, as our mission, then we started getting and creating a bigger and bigger web of partners partnership with farmers all around. And that's how this duck came naturally upstate in Cochecton. But that's what we've been doing. And also what we try to do is not compromise the farmer. So as we grow and as we grow the quantities, because we grow geographically, you know, like since last June, we're now in Chicago. So as we do that, instead of asking the same farmers to grow more of the same animal for us, we are bringing in more farmers into the circle.
So you have farmers who are more local to the markets you're in?
Hey, it depends. When we can, yes.
Now, the name, you picked an unusual name for this.
Rohan,
but explain to us how that came about, because it's easy to confuse the famous city of that name.
Rohan.
Yes, and we want a little bit of that confusion, so this is good. Because there is such a duck, there is a Rouen duck in France, Rouen, like the city, Normandy, R-O-U-E-N, and our Rohan, R-O-H-A-N, that name comes from the family of noble men who actually started the city of Rouen. And then the name changed in France. Because we want people to understand that this duck has a lot, is very close to that Normandy duck. The Normandy duck is a crossbreed between a mallard and a pekin, a canne commune. And our duck is very similar to that, except with the addition of a little bit of Muscovy in it, which adds to the leanness of the duck and the delicate flesh. The pekin side, which is sturdiness of the duck, brings the economical size to it. The touch of Muscovy and the mallard brings the real taste.
Oh, that's what's really amazing, is the flavor of the duck.
Did you notice the dark red meat?
Oh, yes.
It's not gamey at all. It's just a duck. It's just like a duck should taste like.
Now, Ariane, how long did... We interviewed an apple breeder, and it took him 20 years to get this new type of apple. How long did it take you to get this duck?
Well, it took a good 2 years with trial and errors.
So you had errors. You had one that didn't work.
And it's a little bit easier than starting from scratch, because we knew we wanted those three strains in there. So after that, it was a matter of, and for that, a lot of our chef's friends helped us. It was a matter of figuring out when, depending on how much percentage of Muscovy and Mallard was in there, when the duck would mature, and being and processing the duck at that point when he would be adult and fully breasted, but not a week too late because of the price concern and also the texture concern. You still want a very tender duck. And on the other side, you don't want it younger than that, because if you kill it before it's mature, then you have more bones than meat on that duck. And you don't want that either. So we had to play with that a lot, and with the three strains, you know, the percentages.
So you didn't have to cook and eat all the test ones. You had chefs involved as well, so you had a group of people who were working with you. I thought of you having duck for breakfast, lunch, and dinner twice a day.
Yeah. Well, there was a little bit of that, but after a while, you can't do it all yourself because it's too much. You know, you have too much your head product, and so because of that, you don't see it anymore. You don't see the use or the improvement anymore because you know what I mean. When you too much.
Right, you're too involved, you're too close to it. You know, what I kept wondering is, do these different breeds of duck, they don't mind intermarrying? I mean, I was wondering.
They do. Now, the whole industry, whether it's chicken or turkey or duck, the whole industry is about artificial insemination.
Oh, okay, so you don't actually put them out there to...
No, they are in mixed pens, so they can have fun if they want to, but we don't depend on that. We do not depend on that. It takes the fun out of it, but it gives much more reliability on the consistency and on the quantity every week.
Now, the other thing that you're doing that is really important is the product is fresh.
Oh, yeah,
so,
I love that.
So one of the enemies of Long Island duck, and goose in particular, for that matter, is they're delivered frozen.
And
as a result, somehow they sort of get watered down.
That's true. And there are two reasons for that. The one is the frozen versus fresh. And any time you can, make sure you buy a fresh poultry, whether it's a chicken or a turkey or a goose or a duck. It's so important to buy it fresh. So important. And the second thing is, during the process, we actually air chill the duck.
Right.
And that's a very, very important step that will prevent it from being watery. There are two ways to process a poultry, whether it's a chicken or a bigger bird. One is to cool down the bird in ice bath, ice and water bath, for at least 2 hours, but quickly enough so that the temperature goes down as soon as possible from the body temperature down to below 40 degrees so that you don't have issues with bacteria growing. You really want the temperature to go down really fast. So when you put it in water, it does happen pretty fast. When you put it in what we call an air chilling system, it's like a huge refrigerator with big, big wind through. It works as well, except that when you put it in the water, it actually starts retaining water. And you have, do that experience. Go to your supermarket and look at the, there is a sentence on the label that says percentage of retained water in the chicken and anyone. And the people, like the commodity chickens, they can go up sometimes to even 15% water in there, which means that for every dollar you spend for your chicken, 15 cents is just pure dirty water. Whereas with the air chilling system, not only when the duck gets into that high wind refrigeration, when he gets out of there, he's actually lighter than when he came in, so the flavors are more concentrated.
No, it's not frozen. It's chilled. It's not frozen.
It's refrigerated. It's chilled down to 40 degrees. Eventually, it goes in a regular refrigerator that is at 32 degrees, so that duck is fresh all the time. But because of that high wind in that refrigerator, the first refrigerator, it loses all the humidity that it had outside. And so it dries the skin and it makes the flavor so much more concentrated inside. You all experience when you go and buy a boneless, skinless chicken breast, a cheap one, and you put it in the pan and you have all this water coming out. and this is not natural. This is not the juice of the chicken. This is bad water. Yeah. Whereas with an air-chilled bird, that does not happen at all.
Now, we've kept the most important part to last, which is how you get one. And I guess you just go to www.d'artagnan.com.
Yes. But we're starting now to sell to major retailers. Not only the whole Rohan duck, but also we sell the breast that we call the petite duck breast. They are cute. They are 8 ounces each, so they are perfect one size per person. With some cooking instructions, very
easy.
They look
wonderful.
Cook.
They're pre-seasoned.
Yeah, we're cooking those tomorrow. But.
Good. Some plain ones, and we have some marinated ones.
Right.
And so these you can find in stores like Wegmans and King's and Balducci, Fairway.
Do you have those on your website, this retail outlet?
Not sure. Okay. But on the website, you can buy them on the website too.
Anyway, the last and most important thing, I guess, for meal planning purposes is duck is notorious for having a lot of bones in it. We read a number of recipes in the process of trying to figure out how to cook to our Rohan friend when he arrived, and it said, well, you really had to stretch this duck to get it to feed 4 people.
And does not.
But these come in a size of 5 to 5.5 pounds or 5.5 to 6 pounds. The price, by the way, between $32 and $36, and you certainly can feed 4 because we had 2 meals each. Offer our bird friend who
there's
came
even,
to see us.
There's even
yes,
meat the, on the wings, which
yeah.
I found was amazing. Yes.
Yeah. It takes that from the Muscovy, whereas it doesn't have those sturdy bones that the Peking duck has, where you practically a 50% yield on a Long Island duck, a Peking duck,
yeah.
where it's 50%, you know, half bones, half
yeah,
meat.
I know.
Whereas on the Rohan, you have almost 70% meat.
Well, I have to congratulate you. This is a winner. I mean, this is really
wonderful. Thank you.
I'm glad that it caught my eye somewhere, which is why I've got to talk. I love talking to you, Ariane. You always have something interesting going on.
No, me too.
We'll see you at the Fancy Food Show in New York, if not before.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ariane.
And we'll be right back after this short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and welcome to the new, let's call it a food iteration. I like that. I have no idea
food,
what it
food,
means.
No, it sounds really good.
It sounds great.
Very classy.
Which I'm going to define as veganism.
This is veganism very creatively and very innovatively developed by the Secret Supper Lady. More from her.
Merida Anderson, I read your bio and immediately knew I would like you very much person. You've done a lot of things. And you wrote this book, which Peter and I both agree, neither one of us has any interest whatsoever in vegan food. And it is wonderful. It's subtitled, well, first of all, the title is Vegan Secret Supper, which is a concept you'll explain to our listeners. And then it's Bold and Elegant Menus from a Rogue Kitchen, and I guarantee that it's all of that. Welcome to On the Menu.
Thank you.
So we could go over all these other things you did, such as fashion design and going to art school or thinking of going to art school and some of the other things you did.
I was a bike mechanic for a really short while. Probably other things that I've forgotten about already. I used to run an art space gallery.
Oh yeah, you
run
in Vancouver. A gallery, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you've been in Canada and in New York, and now you're back in Montreal, which is a nice place. I like Montreal.
Yes.
But anyhow, you landed into this Secret Supper routine, which seems to have held your attention for a while. Tell us about your Secret Suppers. How did they start, and what form did they take?
Well, they started in Vancouver. I actually had been traveling in the east of Canada, and I was in Halifax, actually, and a friend of mine did something very similar. He had a secret cafe, which was, as well, it was vegan, and I went to it, and he had a big house, and so he had multiple rooms, and people would sit, and you're sitting with lots of different people, and he did, like, a three-course menu, and it just felt like it was just one of the nicest experience I had had eating, especially as a vegan, because even in that time, like in Canada especially, there's not that much choice. And so when I came back to Vancouver, there's not even really a vegan restaurant in Vancouver, and I was like, I really want to do this thing, and I'm always looking for things that aren't real jobs, because I'm terrible at getting real jobs. I'm not very good at it. And I have a weird resume that people are just like, I don't understand what you're doing. And so it was like, this would be really perfect. And I lived in this tiny little attic apartment, and I think my kitchen was the size of maybe a small closet. It could have been a bathroom. Uh-huh. And I told my roommate, I was like, I really want to do this thing. I think it would be really cool, but I know that it would probably take over our whole house. Is that okay? And she was like, she was actually a new vegan, probably the only other vegan I knew, which was interesting. But she was really excited about it and started them there.
And
now, we talked about a variety of things that you did. Did you ever actually have training as a chef? No, you just made that up too. Huh?
Yeah, I did.
Peter was interested in what is the concept behind a secret supper?
I think for me it really just stemmed from the simple thing of that where I was living, there was no place for somebody to go and eat vegan food that wasn't going to be a salad or boring old the same old thing. And also just having a different experience, which is like, I don't know, sitting beside someone that you would never talk to normally and making friends outside of sort of your friends circle and doing things that maybe are a little bit uncomfortable too.
I don't want to spend too much time on the secret supper concept, but I'm still interested. I mean, if it's a secret, how do people find out about it and know to show up?
It's definitely word of mouth. They had a pretty big community to go with in Vancouver, and especially for vegans, because they'll go anywhere for vegan food, I found, and it just spreads like that. People talk about it, and I think because it's such a niche thing, it's not just a supper club that is just regular cuisine. It's so specific. That word will travel a little bit faster because these people just like, they're looking, always looking for a snack.
Now, the range of products you use and the range of recipes is really quite enormous. How did you manage to get this expanse of knowledge?
Well, I guess I've been working on the book for about 4 or 5 years. So that's 4 years of supper club. And every time I did a supper club, every week would be a different menu. And I never wanted to use somebody else's recipes because I felt that was cheating.
But where did you get your ideas? I mean, you obviously couldn't go out and eat vegan food a lot, so you didn't have a lot of experience eating out, right?
That's true. I don't know. I guess just like going to the farmer's market was a big one, picking up a vegetable that I'd never cooked with before, and a lot of it is just really a lot of trial and error, and yeah, it just comes from just trying different things.
No, you start out giving one up to people you're going to use the book. You talk about organics, fermentation, cooking vegetables, nuts, which form an important part of your cuisine, oils, kinds of flours you use, all of those important questions. And then you jump right in. And I think one after another of these recipes, I could see myself making any time. That just sounds so wonderful. Take something like tapenade. You put it, it's just perfectly right on. And there's nothing not vegan about anything in tapenade, right?
Yeah. I think goal for the supper club and also for the book was for people who feel like you guys feel, where you're like, I don't really like vegan food. I don't think about it because it's all beige or it's all tofu, and it doesn't seem like it's going to be good. And I think trying to step away from like this packaged idea, and just that it's like this food is just food, and how you prepare it is how it's good. It doesn't matter, you know, you want to make something and not feel like you're missing anything, like, oh, this dish doesn't feel like it's missing meat or cheese or whatever. Like I think that's the goal, or at least for me.
You don't make fake things.
No, I don't like to use any like packaged stuff.
No, I know you don't make things that are supposed to be something else. You know?
Oh, yeah, totally, yeah.
So I love this porcini pecan nori rolls with ginger pear paper and miso tahini sauce. That's great.
Yeah, you're going to whip some of that up for me tonight?
Yeah, I don't have all that.
It's hard, some of the ingredients hard to find, or, I mean, Montreal undoubtedly has farmers markets, but the season for them is fairly short because it's pretty cold up.
It's true, it's cold, but the growing season is, wow, there's so many things that are going to be coming up in the next couple months. But a lot of the stuff in that book is seasonal, but I try to stay away from crazy. There's not that much imported fresh fruits and vegetables. Like, I'm not using things that might not have heard of. Like, most of them are pretty accessible, I think. You have to go to a health food store to get some of them, but
one of the things that intrigued me and made me read on was in a number of the recipes, especially, I guess, the main course recipes, you call for something and you call it butter. So you have garlic butter and then you have some other kind of vegetable butter. Now, I thought, now, aren't vegans supposed to be non-dairy eating? What's going on here? And I got the message that what's happening is you're making something into the consistency of butter so that it will behave in the same way as butter would do if you had the ability to be able to use it. Did I get that right?
Yeah, that's great.
Amazing.
Tell me this, Merida. I'm picking a recipe here, and I want you to walk me through where you got the ideas for this, okay?
It's okay.
Hazelnut-crusted portobellos with caramelized fennel, parsnip mash, radicchio marmalade, and balsamic port reduction.
This one is definitely came from the idea of, like, more of the fall, winter holiday meals, like a Thanksgiving and Christmas dinners, things like that, which I think is really hard for a vegan, and it's really got that fake turkey thing where people want to remake all these classic things. And I wanted to make something that had the idea and the feeling and a lot of, like, the same flavor components, but is not necessarily this classic, like, oh, this is, you're trying to make a Thanksgiving dinner. But when I eat that, like, when you eat that dish, it does taste like Thanksgiving in a very roundabout way.
It worries me a little bit. It's as though the vegan secret in this is that there really is some dead animal or some dairy in there after all.
No, I promise you there is not.
No, I'm sure. I checked you out really carefully. I read the recipes you call for butter, and there was fake butter. It was butter made out of something other than milk. It's,
you
really
know,
it's fascinating.
We ought to point out is that you also address the gluten-free issue. You have recipes in here that are gluten-free, which seems that's the hot thing today. Everybody's got a gluten intolerance.
Yeah, it does seem that way. And actually, the one thing I forgot to put in that book was pointing out the recipes that are gluten-free, because actually most of them are. I just didn't really make a note of it.
Oh, I read something that said gluten-free, I think.
The one you just read out to me, that one is gluten-free. Like, most of them are, and I feel silly that I didn't write out there so people knew right away. But, yeah, there's quite a few gluten-free options in that book.
Now, are you maintaining access to your secret suppers and your new recipes and that kind of thing through any kind of website or blog?
Yeah, I have a small blog. It's a Tumblr blog, and I do have a website, but I'm not that good at the internet. I'm not that good at keeping up to date, but I do try to update my Tumblr when I take photos of supper clubs that happen, when they're happening and things.
Yeah, I love that your desserts are so creative. They're wonderful. Here people won't notice that they missed a big hunk of steak for dinner.
And that's the goal, I think. That's the goal.
Uh-huh. Well, I think it's wonderful. And some simple things like rosemary olive oil, smoke-infused olive oil, chipotle apple reduction. These are really useful things for any kind of cooking you want to do. And I really hardly recommend this book for anybody, not even just people looking for vegan. They're very tempting and exciting and creative recipes. Again,
and our vegan secret supper tonight is going to be sockeye salmon.
Oh, really? I didn't know what we were having.
It's fake sockeye salmon.
Merida Anderson, good luck to you. Congratulations on your book and keep doing it.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
And don't go away because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And we are back having a delightful conversation with Luca Bombarda about his new leaf rating system for labeling balsamic vinegar.
Well, not only that, it's a wonderful description.
Yeah.
And a definition of what is traditionale and what is not and why and all that mystery surrounding.
Yeah, he knows of what he speaks and he explains it very well. We're going to be talking to Luca Bombarda, who is going to explain to us and help solve this mystery about the production of the famous Balsamico of Modena. Luca has developed, or his company, his family's company, Mazzetti, has developed a new leaf rating system, among other things, to revolutionize the labeling of balsamic vinegar. And we're trying to find out from him what the difference is between the traditional balsamic and the blended balsamic, I think is how you explain it. Tell me about the company, your background, Luca, and what's happening here.
Okay, hi, and thank you for having me.
Yeah.
I'm very happy to have this opportunity to hopefully clarify a little better the difference between different quality of balsamico from Modena. And amazingly, it's a product that is used nowadays, is in every kitchen, but it's still subject to confusion and misleading and misunderstanding. So hopefully I'll try to clarify a little bit some of the aspects of this very ancient, very traditional Italian food product.
Now, we ought to start this, make sure that we clarify that most of the vinegar, so-called balsamic vinegar, that Americans buy in the supermarket has no relationship to the real balsamico at all.
Right. So the first clarification, very, very simple, and it's something that not too many people no, because like you said, most of the consumers here in the United States are actually familiar with the balsamic vinegar that they purchase in regular grocery stores. But they're not too familiar about the existence of another product that shares the name of it, and is traditional balsamic vinegar of Modena, DOP, which stands for Protected Designation of Origin, where the other product is called simply balsamic vinegar of Modena, so not traditional, and is a PGI product, which is a protected geographic indication. These certifications are issued by the European Union to basically preserve and promote authentic products that are originating from particular areas of Europe.
Now, this is a concept that came originally from the wine business, I guess, where the similar terms are used and wine lovers
understand, because it's been going on for hundreds of years, that if something is DOCD, DOC or DOCG, then it's more specifically from a particular region rather than what's called an IGT, which just says it comes from somewhere kind of generally roundabout.
Absolutely.
So that's correct. So you've got the same designation in Balsamico of Modena.
Absolutely. So, in fact, as I said, like traditional is a DOP and regular balsamic vinegar is a PGI. So balsamic vinegar dates back to the ancient Romans time, so it's like a very, very old product. It's very different than regular wine vinegar that was common before the balsamic became so popular. Wine vinegar is obviously made from wine, so it's the fermentation of wine, where balsamic vinegar is basically the fermentation of grape must or cooked grape juice. So there are two products, and therefore there are two methods of production. If you would like to make traditional balsamic vinegar of Modena, you need to start from harvesting the grapes, of course. You squeeze the grapes and you obtain the grape juice or grape must, and then you cook it, this grape juice, for like a long period of time on an open fire, like in a vat. And you cook it down and you almost like reduce this grape juice until it becomes like very thick, very viscous, and very, very sweet, with specific notes of like cooked raisins, plums, licorice a little bit. And you take this product, this cooked grape juice.
Luca, let me just clarify something here. So the distinction here is that in making a wine vinegar, you make wine first. In the case of traditional balsamico, you don't. You cook the grapes and the juice and the skins and everything.
Well, no, you actually cook just the grape juice.
Just the grape juice. So you throw the skins away.
Exactly.
It's interesting because I'm familiar with the term must being used as the ingredient that goes into making grappa.
Grappa, yeah.
And that must is just the skins.
Right. Grappa is made with the grape skin.
Okay. So in this case, it's the grape juice, but it's an unfermented grape juice.
Exactly.
Got it. Okay.
So, in fact, with the cooking, you kind of stop the fermentation because naturally the grape juice turns into alcohol. The sugar turns into alcohol naturally, so the grape juice turns into wine. With the cooking process, you basically stop that process. So before the grape juice turns into wine, then by cooking it, you stop that phase, and then you have, like, again, this liquid which is very syrupy with very rich in sugars, and then you put this cooked grape juice, and you put them in a set of barrels. It's called, in Italian, it's called batteria. Normally, they're like either 5, 7, or 9 barrels. These barrels are a different type of wood, so each wood will impart like a specific aroma and flavor to the product, and that's why traditional balsamic vinegar is such a complex taste. So normally, the type of wood normally used are oak, chestnut wood, cherry wood, ash, and juniper. These barrels are also like a different size. So you start with like more or less a 200-liter capacity, which is equivalent to more or less like 50 gallons. And then the smallest barrel normally is like about 1 or 2 gallons only. So you fill these barrels and with this cooked grape juice, and basically every year you remove part of the content of the smallest barrel and you're topping up that barrel with the barrel before. This method is called like topping up, basically. So every year you repeat the same process, and by law, you have to repeat this process for a minimum of 12 years. So it becomes basically like a blend of different harvests.
The reason, just to stop you for a second, the reason that you're doing this is because all the barrels, some of the vinegar in preparation is evaporating, and you want to fill the battery, want to fill the barrels up, right?
Exactly. So every year, because the barrels, the batteria, is placed in the attics. The attics normally are the areas of the house where they're fully exposed to the weather changes. It's cold, very cold in the winter, and hot in the summer. So basically the fermentation is very slow in the winter months and very fast, obviously, in the summer months with the heat. And so every year you kind of lose, out of this batteria, you kind of lose about 15% or 20% of the content. Part of the product evaporates, as you correctly stated it. Part of the product is absorbed by the wood. and part of the product falls to the bottom of the barrel and to what basically is called, we call the mother, which is basically the bacteria that turns the sugars into acetic acid, into vinegar.
Got it. Now,
every year you have the need of basically topping up all the barrels. And again, you start from the smallest barrel, you take some of the product out, and you refill the smallest barrel with the one before. And then you repeat that process up to the first barrel. And then obviously in the first barrel, you're topping up the first largest barrel with the cooked grape juice from the latest harvest.
Now, that product itself is a product that's used in Italian cooking, is it not? Isn't that what they call Saba?
Saba is basically a cooked grape juice.
Yeah, exactly. So it's
Saba is a term that derives from the Romans, from Latin. And in fact, the Romans during the war campaign 2,000 years ago, they had this product which they used almost like as a condiment. And they used to do basically the same, cook the grape juice so it will not turn into wine, and keep this cooked grape juice or Saba in their flask. Okay. And so when they were going to war campaign and things like that, they would have like a condiment to use. And it was mostly used blended with water, almost as a refreshing soda.
But Luca, now this long process you described of making traditional balsamico, that is what gets rated by this consortium. Is that true?
Yes. There are actually two consortium in Italy. One that is governing the traditional balsamic vinegar of Modena, and then there is another consortium of producers which governs the balsamic vinegar of Modena. So there are two separate consortiums.
And your company does both?
Our company, my family company, produce both products. So we have one of the largest stock of traditional balsamic vinegar, and we also are one of the company, the largest producers of regular balsamic vinegar of Modena.
Now, what you've done recently is to try to change and, if you like, make more predictable the regular balsamico of Modena with a new rating system.
Exactly. And this is the rating, the LEAF system, is a new system that is based on sensory analysis that was first developed privately by my family company, and then it was extended to all the other producers of balsamic vinegar in the hope to create like a standard of identity for the whole industry. And it's very important, and I want to focus on this point. The rating system, the LEAF system, only applies to balsamic vinegar of Modena.
Okay,
does not apply to traditional balsamic vinegar of Modena. Traditional balsamic vinegar of Modena, if I may finish, is basically, like I was saying before, you have this cooked grape juice that you age in these wood barrels for a minimum of 12 years. After 12 years, you take a small sample, you bring it to the consortium of producers where there is like a master panel with master taster. They taste the product, and if your product scores like a certain number of points, they will give you the authority not to bottle it yourself, but to take the product that you have in the barrels in the attic, bring it to the consortium of producers where they provide to bottle it in a single design 3 ounces bottle that is the same for all the producers. For traditional balsamic vinegar, there are only two qualities that are regulated by law. One is called vecchio, or old. That is the product that is aged for a minimum of 12 years. And then there is extra vecchio, which is extra old, which is a product that is aged for a minimum of 25 years. And again, they come in the same bottle. The only difference in between the bottles is the neck tag. One, the 12 years old has a burgundy neck tag, and the 25 years old or extra vecchio has like a gold neck band. So just, this is the
silver
difference.
Silver, gold, yeah.
Now, you had a reason for wanting to have this new system, though, that people could find more reliable, perhaps, right?
Exactly. So for the traditional, consider that because of the method of production, because of the product that you lose during the cooking, the product that you lose every year because of evaporation, because of the wooden barrels that you use are very expensive. They're just made just for vinegar, and normally they're very much more expensive than regular wine barrels. For all these reasons, it's clear, and you have to wait, of course, 12 years. It's clear to understand that traditional balsamic vinegar of Modena is a delicious product, but it's also like a very expensive product. Just a 12 years old can retail easily in a 3 ounces bottle for about $100.
Yeah, I've paid more.
Exactly. At 25 years old, it's $160 or $180 or more.
So take us through the four leaves, if you would, then, and just quickly say now, leaf one, I would find to have this character, and I would use it for this kind of thing, and then the same for two, and then the same for two, three, and four.
Each bottle is different. We have four of them lined up and tasted them.
We sampled them today. Yes.
So the traditional product is the artisan product that dates back century, even just the name traditional and kind of like identify the product. So what is Balsamic Vino Romano? What is the product that people are familiar with and they can easily buy for $5 for a 17 ounces? Balsamic vinegar of Modena is as old as traditional. It just was developed throughout history, since traditional is so expensive and is so thick that if you try to dress a salad, the drop just stay on a single leaf of salad. So it's really not so easy to use. It's very, obviously very, very expensive. So in the area around Modena, they, throughout the years, throughout the history, they basically start blending this traditional balsamic vinegar with regular wine vinegar. So you could still have some notes of balsamic, but it is, the product is obviously a lot less expensive because of the addition of wine vinegar, and is more affordable and easier to use because it's not as thick, not as viscous as the traditional. This is balsamic vinegar of Modena as we know it today. Amazingly, because a lot of people think that traditional is the real product, and balsamic vinegar that people have in the supermarket is the fake product or the industrial product or the inferior item. In reality, by Italian law, balsamic vinegar of Modena was regulated a lot earlier than traditional balsamic. In fact, balsamic vinegar of Modena is 80 years old in the sense that the first law in Italy that came out was from 1933. So this is like an important aspect as well. So balsamic vinegar of Modena is basically cooked grape must and wine vinegar and aged and fermented. So the addition of wine vinegar obviously makes the product different than traditional. Within the balsamic vinegar category, there are a lot of different qualities available. It depends for how long you age the product. It depends how much wine vinegar you add into the mix. And it depends, obviously, on the quality of the ingredient that you use, because you can use good quality wine vinegar or you can use bad quality of wine vinegar. So for all these reasons, and with the escalation and the popularity of balsamic vinegar, especially in the United States market during the 90s and the first year of 2000, you could see a lot of items and with different price point on the shelf. Everything says balsamic vinegar, different presentation, different prices, and different quality. So more often than not, consumers were extremely confused about not just to compare quality and price, but also to compare quality and usage for the product. So for this reason, in a few years ago, again, like we were saying, my family company developed this new grading system, or the leaf system, and it's based, again, on sensory analysis. And we grade all the balsamic vinegar present in the market. We grade all this balsamic, and we categorize them into four major quality categories. Not four major qualities, they're actually categories. And basically, we grade them based on pungency, viscosity, sweetness, color, and aroma, and all these factors. So we apply this trademark symbol, which is a chef hat and a number of vine leaves, 1 through 4, one basically being like the basic quality, that is the application for the one leaf basic quality would be just simple usage, like everyday usage, just to dress a salad, because it's a little zesty, has a little bit of pungency, so you really just want to use it on the salad. Where the 2 and the 3 and obviously the 4, they're like better quality, more sweet, less pungency.
Yeah, but 4 is like the aged stuff. I use it on ice cream with figs.
Exactly. So up to the 4 leaves balsamic vinegar that you can even use on ice cream and strawberries.
Luca, how broadly accepted as this new four-leaf system?
Well, the leaf system, as I say, was developed by my family company, but then eventually we thought it was even better if all the other producers were start adopting the same system. For various reasons, obviously it was not compulsory, it was not mandatory. So for various reasons, not all the producers, unfortunately, agreed to use the same system. Other companies have different systems. So basically, I would say that among the top quality producers, I would say that 10 out of the 17 companies are now adopting the grading system on balsamic vinegar.
Now, Luca, if people want to find out more about this, is there a website they can go to?
They can go to our website.
Go ahead.
Which is www.acetum.it, acetum.it. Acetum basically means vinegar in Latin.
Yeah.
And there is like a full explanation of the whole system and how do we grade all the balsamic vinegar. I still think that actually is a very good system and it helps the consumer tremendously. Again, not just only to compare quality and price, but also to compare the quality with the usage. Sometimes, like people, especially with the popularity of celebrity chefs, and they look at famous chefs using balsamic vinegar on strawberries, and they try to do the same thing. And it's important for them to go in the store and understand that not all the balsamic are alike. And for that particular application on strawberry, you really need to use a four leaf quality. So one leaf quality, you ruin everything, both the balsamic and the strawberry.
Now, I think we really appreciate you taking this time to explain something which has been very mysterious up until now, and I think one might say deliberately so, those people who would try to confuse and deceive. You have done exactly the opposite. I think you and your company are to be congratulated on taking a stance of helping make sure that people's balsamic eau de Modena experience is a good one. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Grazie mille.
Grazie. Ciao.
Ciao, ciao, Luca.
Ciao.
And we'll be right back with a fascinating final segment right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, balsamico has been around for a long time, but our final guest representing the Shaw Bay Distillery in far northern California has been brewing up distilled spirits for 13 generations.
Yeah, I think that's what he said, yes. But not all in northern California.
It sounds like a lot, but that's he finished up in, I think, from Croatia or Serbia or somewhere like that, and is now producing some extraordinarily fine potable spirits that you should sip.
Double dare you to say his name.
I'm not even going to try because...
Marco Karasivic.
Well, you could have waited. We got it right in the interview. So here we go with the interview. Welcome to On the Menu Radio, a 13th generation distiller. And I can't pronounce his last name, so I'm going to hand that off to Anne.
Karakashevich. Thank you for having me on board today, Peter. It's a treat.
And you must have quite a family history going back for several generations, like 12 of them in Serbia.
Yep, that's correct. We've been 1751. My family has been distilling wine. They're distilling spirit, mostly brandies, grappas, making liqueurs. And then there's my dad right there. How you doing? I'm doing an interview right now. So, you know, my family's been distilling, and then my dad came over from Europe, from Serbia, and then we started Shaw Bay in 1983, and this is our 30th year anniversary this year, Peter.
Well, happy birthday, but you probably have several hundredth birthdays.
It's exciting. We make more than just brandy these days. We do whiskeys, made rum, tequila, wines, ports, and our winery.
You said you get bored easily.
Yeah, really.
Now, caught my attention. I started corresponding with your wife, Jenny, who's also with the company, because I read somewhere where you were totally immersed in this R5-aged whiskey.
Yeah.
Which turns out is very good. Tell us about that product.
Yeah, R5 whiskey is... Whiskey's distilled from beer globally, all right? So I started brewing beer in high school, And so when I'm learning more and more about what different spirits were distilled from.
But not all whiskey is distilled from beer.
Yeah, it is.
Well, it's essentially, it's the same raw ingredient.
Same stuff.
What he's saying
corn,
is it's the
you
same.
You get wheat, you get rye, you ferment it into a 4, 5, 6, 7% alcohol solution. You know what? That's beer.
Yes, exactly.
And so if it is beer, then why can't you distill really good beer and make fantastic whiskey?
And so you decided that's what you'd do, huh?
Yep. So good family friend who owns a brewery here in Northern California called the Berry Public Brewery, and they make a fantastic gold medal winning beer called Racer 5 IPA, hops and all. So we get a tanker truck of that, 6,000 gallons, bring it over to a distillery, our distillery, and we distill it. And we distill whiskey from bottle-ready beer. And when you do that, all your beer is all your flavor in your whiskey. So if you have fantastic tasting beer, you get to have fantastic tasting whiskey.
Now most people don't do it that way, right? Most people do the fermentation directly with the barley or the rye or whatever it is they're making, not adding hops or anything like that.
That's correct.
I mean, beer has another vital ingredient, especially IPA, in that it has hops in it as well.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, for example, Old Grandad or Chivas Regal or any one of the brands of whiskey from different corners of the globe, they don't have any hops in them at all.
No one does it.
Except you.
Yeah. I'm sure there's more and more little distilleries going to be starting to do it. But problem is, too, when you pay wholesale for beer, which is about $5 a gallon, and you distill it, and you need 10 gallons of beer to make 1 gallon of whiskey, that is extremely expensive.
Right.
And so that fact alone, I'm not going to say, I don't see a whole lot of distilleries doing it our way because it's ridiculously expensive to do it this way, but we're after the best quality products.
Well, I looked at some of the prices on your website, and everything you make is clearly superior because it's got a superior price associated with it.
And a lot of the stuff is called sold out. That's the other thing I was asking you about.
Well,
his grappa is sold out. His pastis is sold out.
Yeah.
Moonlight whiskey is sold out. His tequila blanco is sold out.
I know. It's a real shame. I hate being sold out, but it's a good thing. This proves point that what we're making is what people want to drink and make products that nobody else on the planet does make. And my dad and I were the first gringo distillers to go down to Mexico and distill our own batch of tequila. And when the Sorbet Tequila Blanco came out in 2010, I was voted Tequila of the Year by Food and Wine Magazine. And then one of our really, really good stores customers, he said, got a problem when one of my favorite tequilas this year is made by American distillers who went down to distill it. He's like, what's going on? So we know what we're doing, and we apply that knowledge to anything that we want to make. And there's really no room for making bad products or cheap products. Like, this is how we survive. We don't make a lot of products. That's why you got a pinner little 50 mil sample of the R5. Like I said, if we made 5,000 barrels of it, I'd give you a bottle for sure. But we make 10 barrels, and then we age it, and we lose it in evaporation. And so we're making a living.
Now, what's the secret? I mean, is there a secret? Is there a gene that you have that's been passed down for 13 generations?
Yeah, there is a secret gene. It's the ASET gene that not too many people have ever seen before, Peter.
Yeah, I'm sure. And your dad got it from his father, we got it from his father, we got it from his father.
That's correct. My son's 20 months old, and he's already twisting the knob on the still, and he knows where to put his finger to try it when it's coming off the pipe, and he gets a big smile on his face. Even if it's tails, he tries and gets a big smile on his face, so it's pretty cool.
No, it's a really funny thing. Now, a lot of people in Scotland in particular, where they make a type of whiskey that, I guess, do you make something like a single Scottish whiskey?
No, I have no desire to, Peter, because that's not my product. The Scotsmen out there, they've got a good thing going. I like hop-flavored whiskey. To me, it makes complete sense. Whiskey is distilled beer, then distill something that you really like to drink. And I like to drink Racer 5 IPA. So I'm one of their best customers. I buy the biggest can I can. It comes with a driver and 18 wheels. So, no, they've got a good thing. We're not here to duplicate anybody else's work. I don't want to make bourbon. It's not what I'm here to do.
It's not what you do, right.
I want to make what I want to make, and what we make at Charbet is completely original and very exciting that way.
Here's a question for you, because this is what I was leading up to. Because if you are to believe the distillers in Scotland, the secret ingredient in their whiskey is the water. And it's water that, in many representations, is exactly the same color as their finished product. In some cases, it's even darker because it runs out of the peat, which is what lies on top of the ground in the north of Scotland. Now, is there anything special about the water that you're using, or is that just to cut the liquor?
The water that we use, is water in the distilled spirits industry is very important. I use water from Mendocino County, and then we have a filtering process that's very clean to start with, but we get it down to 4 parts per million dissolved solids, which is ridiculously clean, and it still has a lot of body. You can use percolated water out of peat, like what they do in Scotland, if you prefer, or pond water, or you can use super clean water, and we use super clean water with a lot of body, like I said, and it makes a lot of difference.
It just feels right to do it that way, right?
Absolutely.
Now, we visited with a very celebrated family-owned business in Friuli in Italy called Nonino, and they make grappa.
Uh-huh.
And they did something very unusual about, was it 30 years ago? The gentleman who is he would say he owns it. His wife and his 3 daughters who all work in the business say that they would really own it. But he decided he would make grappa from a single kind of grape. So he invented a new style grappa.
Yeah.
That was monoclonal, I think, is the way they describe it. Have you thought
about monoclone?
Monoclonal. In other words, it's all
one varietal.
One variety. Yes.
Ooh.
So it's Chardonnay, or it's he started off with relatively sweet grapes.
Uh-huh.
And that, now he's into mixing. He makes a grappa style drink with honey. He makes a grappa style called uve, which is made from grape juice. But it's still a lot like grappa. I'm wondering, are there any ideas here that interest you?
We've made grappa. It's a traditional spirit in Europe. But realistically, we need to make things that people want to buy. And there's a very, very small group of people in the United States, which is, you know, our customer pool, that really want to have grappa. So we've been focusing more on whiskey and vodka and tequila. We have a fantastic situation that we get to take over a distillery in Mexico, my dad and I, and we get to distill our own tequila, which is completely exciting because two of my favorite things in the world are being in Mexico and distilling. So if I get to do both at the same time, that's awesome.
And you get to drink some of it too, no doubt.
That, oh, hell yeah.
That's an excuse for tasting. We were at a whiskey tasting conducted by Booker No.
Uh-huh. A gentleman.
And he was just absolutely hilarious. But
yeah.
People asked him silly questions like, what do you think of small batch bourbon? He said, well, I drink it every day.
Yeah.
He said, because I go check out how it's doing.
Yeah.
But
quality control.
There's only one challenge, I guess, and we talked about it before we came on the air. And this is the last piece of information we need to give to our listeners, because it's going to be quite a challenge to be able to buy some of your wonderful product. So explain to us, not why you can't, but how you can lay your hands on some.
The climate of that.
Oh, you mean at the distillery?
Well, I mean, can you buy it online? Can you buy it at
Charbay.com, yeah, Charbay.
But you were complaining about the state of the California.
In the state of California, if you come over to our distillery, we can set up a tour and we can taste spirits with you, but you can't buy a single bottle from us directly. You have to go to a store, which means we sell it to a distributor. Distributor sells it to the store, and then store sells it at a retail price.
But people can shop online with you.
Correct. Charbay.com, and we can ship to the states that are reciprocal.
And California Curacy isn't one of them, right?
Correct. We can't even ship to customers in our own state. We live in California, for Christ's sakes, and we can't even do that.
Why is it so different?
Sounds kind of silly.
Wine.
Well, we hope that what you have to do is you have to send a few bottles to people who count.
Yeah, right, Peter. I wish I could just send them a couple cases of product and go, here, change the law, but you know how expensive laws are to get changed. It's not a popular vote, meaning, I wish we could just get a petition and have California residents sign it saying, yes, let distilleries sell retail direct to tourists in their distillery. We would have had that done about 30 years ago, but it's a matter of getting a law changed, and it has to go through the House and the Senate and everything in the state. There's lobbyists and there's people against it and people for it, and the bottom line is I'm thinking hopefully this law is going to change one of these years. It's about time.
Maybe it'll be Proposition 21, like the copied after the 21st Amendment to the Constitution.
Yeah, you know what? That would be fantastic. At this point, I don't care what they call it, man. I just want it done.
Well, thank you so much, Marco, for joining us today. Thank you for your contribution.
Yeah, and hello to Jenny, Marco.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity. And, thank you for having me on.
Well, I wish you much luck and success in your business.
Thank you very much.
Well, there you have it, a week of great new tastes and flavors. We hope you'll have the opportunity to explore them for yourselves. And in the meantime, we hope you'll have a great week until you join us again, same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.